Hello and welcome to the Scholars Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're joined by Jennifer Witten Woodring, professor at University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and Douglas Van Bell, senior lecturer at Victoria University. And their book is called The Historical Guide to World Media Freedom. Welcome to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have the two of you. Media freedom and its effects. So I wonder, maybe we should start right there. As you both state in your introduction of your book on this subject, media freedom is thought to be connected to all kinds of important things, good government, democratization, human rights. So maybe we should start by defining what is media freedom? How do you know when it's there? Jennifer Witten Woodring, how would you define it? How do you measure it?
Actually, Doug was the one who started this project and came up with the definition that we use, so I want to give him credit for that. Basically, we define media freedom as an environment in which journalists are able to report critically about government behavior, about issues that are very important, issues that if the people were to become aware of them, for example, they might push for a change in leader if they didn't like what the leader did. Thinking along the lines of Watergate, for example.
Doug Van Bell, what would you add to that?
The definition is a little bit stolen from Robert Entman, where he talked about freedom as the ability to complain. And that's kind of the theme we carried through, was that can you complain about a government official? Can you complain about government? That was really sort of the thing you would look for when deciding whether you had press freedom or not.
And so when you go through and you went country by country by country and said what degree of media freedom each of these countries has, I mean, how do you measure that? Doug Van Bell, how did you guys come up with these essentially, you know, quantifications of how free a country is?
It's surprisingly simple in terms of seeing it, because what you find is that very few countries spend very little time in sort of a halfway or nearly free kind of situation. They very either quickly sort of settle in at on the free side, or they very quickly settle in on the sort of authoritarian control side. And just usually just states in transition that are somewhere in between. So usually they're quite clearly on one side or the other. You can see it through the coverage. You can see it through the reports on reporter harassment and that sort of thing.
And give us some examples so that we can get a sense of this.
Well, Mexico, for a long time, was the only country that was sort of halfway in between. So usually you take your traditional Western states, your United States, your Australia, Canada, those sorts of things. They're going to have different small issues in terms of differences in the nature of press freedom. You're going to have some that are going to have a little more problem with government interference. You're going to have some that have a little more problem with this, that, or the other thing. But on a functional level, they function the same. People can complain. People can protest to get their voices heard. And then as soon as you cross that line, you very quickly go to prison sentences for protesting. So, for instance, Turkey. Turkey has very quickly crossed that line well into the side where you really can't do some of these things anymore.
And Jennifer Witten Woodring, what would you add to this?
Well, I think Mexico is a really interesting example because for years, as a one-party state, firmly under the control of the PRI, Mexico was, by just about anyone's estimation, not a democracy, and yet the media in Mexico were functionally free. That doesn't mean, by the way, that they actually did engage in a lot of criticism of government, but the potential to do so was there. And then what happened in Mexico, as Mexico democratized, there were all these problems with the cartels and so much upheaval that the media environment became not free. So Mexico is one of those really interesting cases because we would expect to see most democracies with media freedom and most non-democracies without it. And yet what Doug and I have found is that that's normally the case. Most media freedom exists in democracies and most absence of media freedom or controlled media exists in non-democracies. But there are exceptions and they're very interesting to look at.
It's interesting you'd mentioned Mexico as being this example. And it seems like from what I've read on Mexico, and they called it the perfect dictatorship before when it was under the control of the PRI, but it seemed like there was a window in which media were free. And then you mentioned the cartels. So in opposition to the government, but also sometimes maybe in conjunction with the government, and yet journalists continue to try to report on that material.
So much of what we know about media freedom comes from studying media in the United States and media in Western Europe. But we, being the Western world, is really advocating for media freedom in non-democratic settings and in countries that are developing, and we don't really know how it functions. And I would say that one of our biggest findings is that if you have media freedom in a non-democratic situation, it really puts journalists in a terrible position. I'm not advocating against media freedom, but what I'm saying is that it puts journalists at risk. And that's, I think, what we're seeing a lot of unfolding right now.
How interesting. So let's look at the relationship of media freedom to its effects, because these are some of the things that you guys have looked at in all of your work. So, for example, democratic peace, that's something, Doug Van Bell, you've explored. What's the relationship there?
Well, that's where this whole project originally started way back in the 90s, looking at countries that go to war with one another. In political science and international relations, we had a great deal of difficulty explaining why democracies didn't seem to go to war with one another. And one of the findings of the press freedom work is that when you have two countries that have free presses, they not only don't go to war, they don't escalate to smaller lethal conflicts either. So you'll get two free press states going right up to the point where casualties are inflicted and then stopping and quickly de-escalating. And the reason is the nature of communication between the two countries is that in order to justify killing somebody in another country, you have to dehumanize them. The flow of information between two free press countries and the news media in both countries treating the people of the other country as the same as themselves prevents that from happening, and you get these instances where you get one or two casualties in a conflict between two free media countries, and it's just devastating for the leadership of the country because the public reacts very, very negatively to that.
It's interesting because you're saying it takes two media-free countries. But if we look at the United States history, it certainly is engaged in a lot of conflicts with not necessarily free media countries, but non-free media countries. Iraq would be the perfect example. There certainly was a lot of dehumanization in the U.S. side, right?
Yeah, and it's because the information coming from the non-free press country is treated like either as if it's propaganda or as if it's unreliable or in some other way that makes it seem less valid. And in that situation, the leader in the democratic country can basically create any image they want of the other side, because everything coming from the other side has to be in some way confirmed as reasonable. And all you have to do is then fight that confirmation. And it's pretty easy to do.
So Jennifer, you've also looked at media effects, media freedom effects, and you looked at, for example, intolerance, civil conflict. Is there a relationship there?
Well, what I found in some work that I've done with Mark Hutchison, co-author, is that media freedom combined with a high level of intolerance in a society is actually associated with increased civil conflict. Actually makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, because if you have a high level of social intolerance and you have media, news media being commercially dependent on getting the largest audience that they can get, the news media are going to cater to the social intolerance. And case that we looked at, we did a statistical analysis looking across countries and found that there was a significant effect. And then we looked specifically at the conflict in India, Gujarat, where there was some very interesting local media coverage that really seemed to inflame the conflict there between the Muslims and the Hindus.
So then I suppose the historic narratives, the culture, the institutions all together all would play a role there, right?
Absolutely. And just that the, if media are free and independent, they're going to cater to their audience most likely. And because all news organizations need an audience in order to continue and survive, whether they're dependent financially on that or they want to be heard. That's the whole point. And so in order to get that audience, they're going to cater to that audience. And if you have an intolerant audience, you're going to have the potential for media to really magnify and magnify that intolerance.
And so you could end up with a vicious circle situation where in order to get audience, media focus on this like blame and dehumanization of whoever they deem as the others or the bad guys, and then that could facilitate growing intolerant environments.
I think so. And I think if you think about this idea of echo chambers, because now in today's world we have so many sources that we can go to for our news and information and our entertainment. And people are inclined to seek out sources that are in sync with their viewpoints. And I think you can have echo chambers form around all different kinds of ideologies. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that we're seeing. So, for example, here you read about something in a newspaper or online, that in a blog that really sort of fits with your point of view, and then you hear it on the radio or you see it on television, and it's just you're hearing so much your point of view that you're not hearing other points of view, and it really reinforces your own intolerance.
One of the other things that you also mentioned in the book is about the responsibilities that come with media freedoms. In other words, media freedom does not mean you have a freedom to spread hate, for example. But how does this fit in with all the research that you have been doing?
Absolutely. Doug and I have found that free news media are not guaranteed to be responsible news media. If you look at what happened in Uganda, where you have a non-democratic setting, a highly intolerant society as far as it comes to homosexuality, and you have news organizations that are incredibly irresponsible. So you had this tabloid, there were actually several tabloids, but the one that was the first to do, or the first to get noticed for doing so, was this tabloid called the Rolling Stone, no affiliation with the magazine in the United States. But the Rolling Stone published pictures of people that the Rolling Stone said were gay and had just this terrible message saying, hang them, a banner, hang them. And a guy who was featured on the front page of that edition actually was eventually killed.
Wow. That wouldn't be the first place that something like that had happened, right? So certainly no. We've all examined some of the things that happened in, say, Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia, similar kinds of, you know, media messages and then the echo chamber like you described. So then the question becomes, where is the line between media freedom and media responsibility? Doug Van Bell, would you have a sense about that from all the studies you've done?
There's two things to think about, and that is, one, when we talk about media freedom, we're talking about that right to complain and criticize. So that's sort of different than no rules for the media. So something such as the fairness doctrine that the U.S. used to have, which, well, I would argue is the big problem with U.S. media freedom at the moment, is that it's no longer there. That's perfectly compatible with the nature of media freedom. Limitations on hate speech are perfectly compatible with this idea that you can criticize government and powerful officials. So if you go to different countries around the world, you have different ways of trying to maintain that ability to criticize, to create that feedback into government from the public, while still keeping that responsibility for sort of civilized behavior. So here in New Zealand, we have a far different set of laws around media freedom and such. And even though it's more restrictive here in what you can report, most would argue that it works better here than it does in the United States at the moment. And so you can similarly see these things around the world in terms of liability laws, libel laws, safe speech laws, hate speech laws. Those are all compatible with media freedom and are a way of embodying the responsibility aspect as long as they don't limit that ability to criticize government.
Jennifer, anything you'd want to add to that?
Just that the problem with pushing for media to be responsible is that it can very quickly cross into a push to control media. For example, Kagame in Rwanda, the current leader of Rwanda, has used Rwanda's history with the radio stations being used to mobilize people in the genocide there. He's used that history to make a claim that, well, we can't have media freedom in Rwanda right now, and that it needs to be controlled because of the danger there.
The fear of the civil conflict and intolerance.
Right, right. So I think that it's a bit of a slippery slope. Anti-hate speech laws are probably the best option that we have for helping to strike that balance. But then when you get into saying, you know, well, what's responsible, what's irresponsible, who gets to say what's responsible and what's irresponsible? Do you require journalists to be licensed? Well, who gets to decide who gets a license and who doesn't? It very quickly gets very complicated. So leaders don't like being criticized. In a lot of countries, we see criticism of the leaders or the ruling family criminalized, and that's a form of control. Mm-hmm. So trying to get media to be responsible can very quickly get turned into a form of media control beyond control aimed at keeping media responsible. So it is difficult.
Yeah, it's one of those little fine lines that can get moved into the wrong direction, I suppose. You know, one of the other things that I always think about when I think about media freedom is that we always contextualize it in terms of criticizing the government, the right to complain about government. But, you know, it seems like there is also another form of constraint on media, and that is this sort of constraint to make a corporate profit, which also kind of ties the hands of journalists in terms of doing certain kinds of exposés or covering certain kinds of stories that, you know, might be critical of a particular business or economic system or something like that. Has that ever been something that has come on your radar?
It does come on the radar. Generally, what you find is, if you look into it, it's rare that a situation like that reaches the point where it actually threatens media freedom. You have several instances where it's problematic in an individual case or in regards to an individual corporation and that sort of thing. But if you have enough media outlets in a state or a nation, generally what you will find is that if that information is there, someone will bring it out. And so what we look at is there a way for those, you know, corporations to stop it from coming out at all? That's really going to be the real danger sign, is if a corporation can shut down a critical area of coverage. If they can shut it down entirely through legal means, for instance, through use of libel law and that sort of thing, that is a big danger sign in terms of media freedom.
I suppose I ask that partly for two reasons. One of the journalists I had interviewed was in Russia, and he said that in Russia, their big concern is less about government repression and more about these corporations that own the media and also are affiliated with particular politicians or political parties. And so it's ownership structure that prevents them. It's self-censorship rather than, you know, it's their job, not their,
right.
That they're necessarily going to go to jail.
Yeah, the news media in Russia isn't anywhere near free. There was some hints that it might have gone that direction. But what you're talking about is sort of what's often called a captured news media. And you see these in, for instance, you used to see that in Spain, where there was no official censorship, but under Franco, all of the media outlets were owned by the government's friends and therefore were indirectly controlled through those economic relationships. You saw it in Latin America in the 1970s through the control of paper for the printing presses. Basically, the government didn't control the news media. They controlled whether or not the news media could have paper to print on. So those are the sorts of things you see. It's when that eliminates the ability to cover by all of the news media, that's when it really becomes problematic. It's something to be watchful for and to be alert for as sort of a maintenance level in your own, you know, media free media countries. But it's not that often that it rises to the point where it threatens media freedom.
Jennifer Witten Woodring?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why it isn't as much of a problem as we might assume that it would be is that news organizations depend on credibility. And if you fail to cover a story that's important in today's world, it's probably going to be covered by another news organization. And then you're not going to look very credible, and people aren't going to want to tune into you. So there's this fear of losing credibility that in some cases I think really helps to keep news media at least honest. And you may have a news organization that will not initially cover a story, but if it's being covered by, you know, not being covered by mainstream media, but gets picked up by what we would characterize as more fringe special interest media, eventually it's going to reach a level where the mainstream media can't ignore it or they're going to lose credibility. So I think that is one of the factors that keeps that from becoming as much of a problem in a free media environment as you might think. But, you know, there's certainly there are a lot of ways that media are controlled in non-free environments where there's a lot of self-censorship on the part of journalists, because they know that if they report critically, they're going to pay a high cost, maybe even their own lives.
Exactly. So maybe that's the distinction that we really are drawing when we're talking about true media freedom is, are you going to pay for this with your life? Not necessarily your job, but your life, like imprisonment, death, that kind of a thing. So I wonder also if we could take a look at all the countries that you evaluated. And first, kind of one of the things you did was break them into geographic regions. What were the patterns that you saw in terms of media freedom in these geographic regions? Jennifer Witten Woodring?
One of the most interesting patterns that I noticed was in Africa. So as countries gained independence from their colonizers, initially there would be this period of media freedom, or it would look like media were going to be operating in a free manner. And then, in the power vacuum created by independence, the leadership would become more and more authoritarian, and that media independence in many cases would just go away. And then, after years and years of struggle, we see some of these countries emerging with free media systems. So you'll see an initial period of media freedom followed by a big shutdown of media freedom. That was one of the patterns I noticed in Africa.
Doug Van Bell, any pattern that you'd like to bring out?
There was and we haven't looked in the new data for this pattern, but we found a pattern in the overall, in the first cut of the data that went through the mid-90s. And that was when you had a U.S. president that attacked the media at home, you found that the media, the press freedom abroad also declined. And one of the things you would see was that when a U.S. president, such as Richard Nixon in the 70s, attacked the news media in the U.S., countries overseas, you would have dictators then turn around and copy that and attack their own news media. Whether it's they felt free from the U.S. pressure to be free, to be democratic, or whether they just simply copied that policy action or not, but it was a pretty striking pattern that we saw, that news media steadily increases over the years. It's been a steady, steady increase. And then you get these setbacks, and these setbacks always occur right after you have a U.S. president going in and criticizing and attacking the media in one way or another.
That's fascinating, actually. You know, I guess we can't really let you go unless we do sort of a typical media thing and say, all right, well, who's the worst and who's the best in terms of media freedom? What was the least free country or countries that you found? Jennifer Witten Woodring?
Well, that's hard because there's a lot of competition in that category. I mean, obviously, North Korea would be one. Doug, did you want to add to that?
No, North Korea is the hands-down obvious answer. You get a lot of dictators around the world, but nobody does crazy media control like those guys up in North Korea. It's insane to the point where it's just astounding.
And then in terms of the most free, who would you say? What would you say?
Not the
U.S. I would
US.
Actually argue that there isn't a most free. I would actually argue that once you get a functional free press, The variations tend to become variations of form rather than actual freedom. So as long as you're not in that situation where you've actually got threats to freedom and the ability to criticize, you get variations in form rather than variations in levels of freedom. So if you look at, for instance, the Nordic countries, they always rank very, very high on people's measures of freedom. But they have very strict controls over what counts as news, news organizations, funding systems for news and that sort of thing. Whereas you get the United States, where in terms of sort of freedom in a sort of intellectual sense, in terms of anything goes, you have that going in the United States. You can literally report anything you want and call it news. Which you can't do in most other free press countries. Many argue that the United States is nowhere near as good a free press country as someplace like Britain or New Zealand, where they have controls on you have to be truthful and those sorts of things.
Jennifer Witten Woodring, last word.
I get the last word? Oh, my goodness. Well, I think that what we found in writing the book was that media freedom isn't always where you would expect it to be. So it does exist in countries that are really lacking in other democratic characteristics. And similarly, there are democracies that have a surprising amount of control exerted over media. So I think if we left you with anything, that would be it.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer Witten Woodring and Douglas Van Bell, for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. It's really fascinating.
Thank you for having us.
That was Jennifer Witten Woodring, professor at University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and Douglas Van Bell, senior lecturer at Victoria University. And their book is called The Historical Guide to World Media Freedom.